Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 163 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. It's time for our annual check-in with the great mastering engineer, Kevin Gray. A year ago, he told us about how he was coming off his busiest year yet. Now I feel like I'm seeing Gray's name on more releases than ever, and they're usually outstanding. How did his 2024 compare to 2023? He recaps it for us. He did a lot of work for the Rhino High Fidelity series, including the Doors 1967 to 1971 box set, which includes the six original studio albums the Doors recorded with Jim Morrison. This was a limited edition release of 3,000 copies and it sold out within a couple of days. There have been a lot of previous versions of these Doors albums, including 45 RPM releases from Analog Productions and highly coveted ones from DCC that Gray also oversaw. Did Gray and previous Caro Pop guest Bruce Botnick, who engineered the first five Doors albums and produced LA Woman, refer to earlier pressings as they worked together on these? What new, if anything, were they able to bring to the Rhino High Fidelity box? Gray talks about some of the other Rhino High Fidelity releases he has done, including the Ramones' Road to Ruin, the Stooges' self-titled debut, Yes's Relayer, Devo's Freedom of Choice, and titles from John Coltrane and Herbie Hancock. Which one of those doesn't make sense to him as an audiophile release? I also ask him about versions of Yes's Fragile that he has mastered for Analog Productions and Atlantic. Why does one sound better to me than the other? Then there are all of the Tone Poet and Classic Vinyl Series jazz albums he's still mastering for Blue Note, and more he's doing for Kraft Recording's original jazz classics. How does he juggle it all? Which company works way in advance, and which one keeps him rushing? Is he still learning anything? Why does he have mixed feelings about 45 RPM releases? Which expensive type of release does he consider to be, and I quote, an absolute scam foisted on the buying public? He explains in detail. Gray has been running his own studio and Coherent Records label as well. He has recorded and released jazz albums from saxophonist Kirsten Edkins and guitarist Anthony Wilson over the past couple of years. What is the third album that he's now preparing for release? How does he plan to balance running a label with mastering albums in the near future? I always enjoy talking with Kevin Gray and learn a ton from these conversations. This one is no exception. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Kevin Gray. Good to talk to you again. I appreciate our annual chat. This is our fourth one now.
Always great talking to you, Mark. I always enjoy it. Look forward to it.
This time last year, we were talking and it was like your busiest year yet. So you kind of chilled out and didn't do as much in 2024, right?
Well, technically, that's correct in that I turned a lot of business away. And, you know, when I look at my month by month on QuickBooks, I did do a little less this year financially. But when I look at the stack of you know, the notes that I keep for all the projects I've done, this year's stack is as big as last year's stack. So maybe I did more two record sets last year than this year or something, because I've been busy as all get out. And the end of the year was just crazy.
Yeah, it seems like, I mean, there have been a lot of high profile releases with your name on them, which we will talk about. But yeah, tell me about that end of the year rush. So we're talking, it's like the end of the year. So, and you're just like taking your, you're having your exhale moment and talking to me.
I am. Yeah, no, the end of the year was particularly crazy this year because a label that I won't mention because it hasn't been announced decided to do, well, I can mention the label, it was Rhino. Rhino had another box set to do, but it was a giant rush. It had to be to the plant. Initially, they told me before the 10th of January. Okay, fine. They told me this in October, and they said, and we'll have everything to you before Thanksgiving. Well, nothing showed up until the 4th of January. That's middle of the week. I can only ship to Europe on Monday and Tuesday, so I lost another week there. And then these five albums for a box had to be finished now by they wanted them at the plant by the 19th of December.
Wow. So they gave it to you later and moved up the deadline.
Exactly.
That's all.
Yeah, that's all. And it, you know, it wasn't like that was the only thing I was doing. You know, I had other work going too, but that was, of course, the big rush.
Well, you keep saying Rush. Is that a hint of who it is?
No.
Or you can get rumors out about the new Rush box from Rhino.
No.
Now, is this so you had the Doors box that came out a few months ago, like November, actually. It wasn't even that long ago. And it was so this is like that. It's like that. So it's a Rhino High Fidelity 5 LP box set.
That's correct.
Rhino was 6, but yeah. And is it going to come out like late next year, or is it coming earlier?
That's why they moved it up. There's been no announcement. Yeah, well, you know, with this big giant rush to get into the plant, I'm wondering if they're not trying to get it out by Record Store Day or something. You know, not like it's for Record Store Day, but to have it out at that time so it would be in the stores, et cetera, et cetera. Because I don't think this band is going to sell like the Doors did. I mean, they're great, but, you know, that Doors box sold out in 2 days, which was insane.
Right. I bought it.
I told them to do 5,000. They didn't listen to me.
No, I was like, I shouldn't have, my wife might hear this, so I don't know if I should admit this, but I did see, oh, it's going really fast. I would like to have this professionally. I want to be able to discuss it with you. So I just bought it. I didn't, you know, so it sounds great. It's really cool. And I remember talking to you about the possibility of that coming out and that happening. And it's an interesting one because those records have been done many times, yet this is kind of being taken again. It sold out very quickly because people thought, oh, this is going to be a definitive package of these records, even though they've been done so many times.
Yeah, that's the case. You know, working on that project was kind of the high point of the year for me. I got to work with Bruce Botnick, who I hadn't worked with in 50 years. I had actually worked with him once.
Wow.
Back in the early 70s. And we had a great time. We had a great time. It was very fun.
I had Bruce Botnick on earlier in 2024, and we talked about the Doors, and we talked about Love. You know, he produced, you know, produced and engineered those records, which are so fantastic. And you know, there was one Doors live set that was coming out around Record Store Day. Then they had another one that just came out in Detroit Black Friday Record Store Day. Right. And then there were these records, even though Vinyl Me Please had just done a mono version of the Doors debut album, and there were other ones, but like, what was it that made it like, all right, we're going to do a Doors box, but we're going to do it like in this definitive way, even though it's been done a bunch of times, this is going to be the one you're going to want to get.
I don't know if I can answer that question. I mean, the fact that Bruce and I worked together on it, I think probably accounts for a bit. And, you know, it was all the original master tapes except for the first album, which had been discussed before, you know, that disappeared in 2007 or somewhere around there. They haven't had it for any of the reissues, including the one that you know, Bernie did with Bruce in 2008 or whatever that was.
Right.
So, but every other one, we had the original master tape, and Bruce was kind enough to bring in all of his originals, so we had that to compare to. I had the 2008 box. I didn't actually have Chad's 45 version that he did with Doug Sachs, but let's see, I had the DCC, so we had a lot of things to compare it to.
So are you comparing it, are you listening to all of them before you do your work, or do you do your work and then kind of go back and think, okay, now how do these other ones sound?
Well, while I have the master tape up, I would put on a copy, you know, a version and see how my settings compared to what they were doing. And sometimes they were right in sync and sometimes they were quite a bit different. You know, it just varied from album to album.
Was there one of those that you thought was the best one up to what you were doing?
A reissue?
Either the original or the analog productions or whatever. Was there one where you put it on and you thought, oh, this is about as good as it's been so far?
Well, yeah. You know, I guess I'm a little prejudiced because three of the six were cut at Artisan Sound, my old alma mater. I was actually there when they were cutting Lacquers on Morrison Hotel. I heard L.A. Woman before it was released.
Wow.
I wasn't around early enough to come in for Soft Parade, but I had all of the original Artisan cuts, and I still think, you know, I tried to keep those three titles in particular as close to that as possible, because I thought they sounded great. I think I didn't. There was one original missing, which was Soft Parade. I could not find mine. I know I had it at one point. And Bruce had it. He said at one point it was not there. So all we had to compare on that was the 2008 box and the, I think there was a DCC of it, but I'm not sure. I think it was just a test pressing. I don't know if they ever released it. But anyway, I remember Bruce was rather emphatic. This record needs a little more bass. And I said, yes, I agree. You know, just listening to the flat tape.
Right.
And so, yeah. So we added some more bass to it. And I honestly don't know how that compares, you know, to the original or to the, you know, Chad's box.
Soft Parade sounded fantastic to me. I mean, it's a weird record, but like the title track of it, which is just kind of going all over the place, like the percussion and everything, it really popped in a way that I didn't remember having heard it, hearing it pop like that before.
Yeah, well, the issue with that record is it's so bright because of the horns and everything that it needs some bass to kind of balance it out.
Did Bruce have a, I mean, because you were working with him on this, Bruce Botnick, who produced or, you know, engineered all those original records.
Correct. And did produced he, LA did Woman.
He, yeah, and produced LA Woman, right. So he produced LA Woman and engineered them all up to that point. What was there anything that, you know, was there sort of a mission statement going into this? Like, I want these to sound, I want these to accomplish something that I feel like had, you know, needs to be accomplished at this point?
I would love to say yes, but I really think the answer is no. I think Bruce almost seemed a little bewildered that we were doing this again, you know. Huh. I think Patrick Milligan, you know, from Rhino,
right,
talked him into doing it. I think that was the story. And, you know, I don't know whether that's the official story. I don't know. But that's from my perspective, that's the story. And Bruce was happy to do it. And like I said, he came in the door and he was great to work with. And yeah. So
I remember talking with him about the first album, and there was a whole sort of speed correction issue there where it's like it's kind of going at the wrong speed. You guys didn't correct that, though, right? It seems like you went with what the original record sounded like versus what the original record was supposed to sound like before the speed got messed up.
Well, I'm not sure that this, I don't think the speed problem was with the original tape. I think it was with the tape machine that they played it on in the mastering facility. Because when I put up, you know, an original Monarch, you know, first generation pressing against the tape that we had, the speed matched pretty damn close. So that's all I can guess about that.
I need to go back on that. But there wasn't like some discussion on like what speed to master this at or anything.
Not at all. Not at all. And the thing that was a little odd and frustrating was Bruce was pretty adamant that he didn't want the tapes played any more than absolutely positively necessary. So when he did the 2008 release, he made flat transfers of all of the master tapes. And we were actually listening to a 24-192 for the rundown, you know, for making EQ decisions and all of that. Then we threaded up the tape and cut it. And so it was a little tricky, to say the least.
Just to make sure that you had minimal contact with the actual original masters.
Yeah, most of these tapes were recorded on Scotch 201. I think all of them except for LA Woman, which I think was on 206, which is a real robust tape. The problem with Scotch 201, it's not a baking issue. There was no problem with that. But the oxide would literally flake off with a lot of plays. And you could actually hold it up to the light and see like pinholes through it, you know. And so Bruce did not want them played any more than absolutely necessary. And, you know, it was a good call. I didn't have any problem with that.
Had there been degradation of these tapes at all? Like, could you sort of tell that these don't sound like what they sounded like? You know,
No. They all sounded good because he's been very, very protective of them the whole way along.
So, I mean, they sound great the way it came out, so it doesn't sound like it's missing a lot, but I was sort of
wondering if there was something
you might have noticed.
Well, like I said, you know, I was comparing them to the originals, and you know, I think we were able to better them, you know, just because I think, you know, my cutting electronics are better than what Bob had at Artisan in 1969, 70, 71.
Right. And then it uses the... the original release version of like Break On Through and the end that has sort of the censored parts of it. So, you know, you're in She Get instead of She Get High. Was there discussion about that, or was it always like, we're going to put out the record as it originally came out and not the way we released it later?
Yeah, we were trying to match the OG, as we tend to call it in the biz.
Right.
So,
was there anything from, I mean, you've heard these records a lot and you were around when they were coming out originally. Was there anything new to you from this? Like, that did you think of any of it differently because you were re-encountering this music in such a up close and personal way because you're cutting the record on your equipment now?
I can't really say that that's the case because I was so familiar with the originals. I think the tape, and I hope the record, the resulting record that I cut of the first album, sounded better than any of the original pressings that we listened to. We had two originals on that, the Monarch being the one that everybody talks about being the one to beat. So I think that was probably the biggest surprise. I think, well, that was one surprise. There was another surprise, and that was how I thought the sound improved with the second album. And I'm guessing what happened was that there were probably, you know, it was an 8-track where the original was 4, and the first album, I mean. And so I think in recording at 8-track, they probably didn't have to do as much bouncing, you know, to do overdubs. So, you know, with 8 channels. So,
yeah, Strange Days was actually the first Doors record I ever bought because I had that kind of psychedelic thing going on, and I was into that. So,
you know, so many people have told me that. That's very interesting. I didn't buy it in the day. I bought it later on. Soft Parade was the first record that I bought.
Oh yeah. No, I think it was that and actually LA Woman, because LA Woman was like the 5-star Rolling Stone record guide album. But it was like, but I like LA Woman more now because I've come more around to that kind of bluesy stuff. But at the time I was I like the poppier stuff and the more psychedelic stuff.
So you probably didn't like Morrison because that was very, very bluesy.
I did like Morrison though, because especially side one of it. Because yeah, I still like Roadhouse Blues, but I also like Peace Frog a lot. I thought Peace Frog was just it was just such a fun song. And so I liked Morrison Hotel. Parade was probably the last one I heard.
One thing that was pretty cool was when I was hanging out at Artisan Sound. I went in on a Sunday afternoon, and that was when Bob was cutting the lacquers for Morrison Hotel. You know, he'd rented down with Bruce. They'd had the refs. Everything had been approved. So he's cutting it on a Sunday afternoon, and I got to hang out with him, and he blew a lacquer on it. I think he had to drop the level like a half a dB to get it to fit. So it ran in too far to the label, and he kind of tossed it aside. And I was thinking, geez, I wish I could have that, you know? Mm. And about 3 days later, Bob drives over to my house and he's got the lacquer and he goes, you know, I don't know what I was thinking. I should have given this to you. And I said, so awesome. And I still have it. And I got Bruce to actually autograph what would be the label area with a grease pencil. So
that is a great collector's item right there.
Boy, and it still sounds great. And it's probably been played 100 times easy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how it sounds if you just like could put it on.
It's noisier than it's probably not much noisier than the pressings in the day, you know, but it doesn't sound like an audiophile release of it. But sonically, it sounds really good.
And you had a lot of Rhino high fidelity releases this year. They came out more frequently than I realized they were going to.
Well, far more frequently than they initially said they were going to be. When they first, you know, hit me with a project, the concept, when Patrick called me and told me what the concept was, I said, oh man, it's not like I need a whole lot more work like this, you know, of what would you call a program, you know, a program of releases. And so he said, oh no, it's only going to be 2 titles twice a year. And it's like, okay, yeah, I can fit that in. No problem. Well, look what's happened. So now I think it's 2 titles every other month, and which is what, 6 a year. And box sets, you know. So.
Right. I was going to say the Doors box, which was 6 records, was not part of that. Like, that was a bonus.
Yeah. Well, and so was the ZZ Top box before that.
Right. So I talked to you again a year ago. How many of the ones that came out this year had you already finished?
Oh, quite a few.
Because I remember you saying that you were working pretty far ahead. So did you have a notion then
but the
that
box sets are not that way? The box sets I'm always doing at the last minute,
right,
which is crazy. You know, I mean, those are the ones that, you know, would be nice to take the most time on, you know,
but like, you know, Devo, Stooges, Yes.
Those were cut this year, but, you know, quite a, you know, several months back, you know, probably 8 months ago.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. So they've cut back on the, and when I talked to Patrick for his Carol Pop episode, he talked about how he was going to sort of pull back on the jazz titles. So like the month where they had Ole Coltrane and Tutu from Miles Davis, looks like it was it.
Yeah. Oh, there's also Herbie Hancock and
I think that was beforehand.
Miles. Yeah. And I loved that. What was that called? Coltrane Sounds. The first,
that was an early one. Yeah,
I love that record. You know,
yeah, that one sounds great. That one sounds. You do a lot of jazz, obviously, already with Blue Note, Tone Poet, Classic Vinyl. Yeah, I was thinking even like, you know, Yes, Relayer is this very dense, intricate record that it's almost sort of has a free jazz thing going on Gates of Delirium, that side one long song. And then you've also got the Stooges self-titled debut and the Ramones Road to Ruin, which are very stripped down. I mean, do these require different skill sets to do those records?
I wouldn't say so. It's just a matter of putting them up and listening to them and just, you know, my mindset on every single thing that I do is, how is this going to strike the guy at home who has a really nice audio system? I'm not going for lowest common denominator, but, you know, a guy who's got, you know, a $5,000 audio system or a $300,000 audio system, how is he going to want this to sound? How is he going to want to hear this? So that's kind of the criteria I use for everything.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, something like Relayer, again, there's so many details in there that you're bringing out. Cause there's this kind of head swirling record, it's like Prague with a capital P.
That's not my favorite Yes album. I kind of like, you know, Fragile and what was the other one that followed
Close to the Edge?
Yeah.
And then the Yes album.
I like those a lot.
You know, and then Stooges, you know, and Road to Ruin for that matter. I mean, those are records that people just turned up loud, you know, you want it to sound great on your audiophile system, but you also want it to, you know, punch you in the chest.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm not a big fan of the Stooges type stuff for an audiophile release. I mean, I find those two things kind of mutually exclusive. I don't know, but yeah, that's just me.
Right. People are saying, oh, that first Stooges record sounds as better than it's ever sounded. So,
well, thank you.
So what's the key to, I mean, again, it's a part of it is just your ears. It's you have this wonderful, you know, equipment that you've built.
It's class A solid state transformerless. That's what makes our system unique.
And you've improved it over the years.
A bit. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that's making that Stooges record that is not an audiophile release sound better to people than other ones that have come out? Is it something as simple as, well, most mastering jobs don't quite get that full dimensional percussion sound? The drums are different. Is it just that the mid-range is better? Is it that the sound stage is broader? Is it just all of the above?
Yes, it's all of the above. I mean, it's partially me, it's partially my system. When I say me, I mean the choices that I make, EQ wise, that sort of thing. I don't remember specifically what I did to that record, EQ wise, but it's a raw record by all means. And the same with the first Television record. You know, that to me, that sounded very raw.
Right,
you're talking about that one. But
yeah. And when you get feedback on how these records turn out, like, does that inform anything, or is it just kind of interesting to you? Or they're like, oh, okay, people like this one. People complained about this aspect, or whatever else. I mean, most of them, obviously, I mean, it's been a very popular series, but yeah, is there any sort of feedback that's been helpful to you? Or is it just like, you know, you do your job and they're, you know, onto the next one?
Exactly. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how I would incorporate criticisms into the very next project that I'm doing, because they're so different sounding to begin with, you know. You know, like you know, the Ramones and the Stooges, that's a perfect example. I mean, I love the way the Ramones sounded compared to the Stooges, you know.
The Ramones you're good at with for people on their $3,000 system, but Stooges you're not so sure.
That would be a good way to put it.
How about Devo Freedom of Choice, which is a record I've always really liked, but it seems like there's, you know,
I like that record a lot. I always have.
And it's not, your version of it sounds really great, but it's also, you know, electronic instruments as opposed to capturing the room or something like that. Is that a different task also, different assignment?
Not really. I'm still using the same criteria, as I said, you know.
Right.
How's this going to sound on this guy's $3,000 to $30,000 to $300,000 sound system?
And you mentioned Fragile, and you've done at least a couple of versions of that, because there's a Analog Productions version from I think 2006 that was redone. Was it 2011? I have this down somewhere in my notes.
I think that was mine also, I think.
Yeah, and then there's one that Atlantic put out just a few years ago that also has a sticker on it, mastered by Kevin Gray at Coherent Audio. And I have a black vinyl of that. And I think there's a clear vinyl of it that came out last year as well. I actually picked up the Analog production one, the 200 gram one, at a record convention, just out of curiosity, because someone had it marked down. And I had just gotten the one that you did just a few years ago. They don't sound identical, even though you did them both. Like, what's the difference?
Was the acoustic sounds one, was that 33 or 45?
It was 33.
Was it also 33?
It was 33. Yeah, so it's Analog Productions, and it's 200 gram, and it came out in 2012. Yeah. And then I think it was 2016, 180 gram on Atlantic.
I think that used the same parts, if I'm not mistaken. I don't think I recut it between 2011 and 2016 or whatever that was.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They don't sound the same, though. And the less expensive one is the one that has the, to my ears, and my daughter Ruthie, who you've met, I made her do a little A/B, and I said, listen to these two, and it seems like there's a sort of a higher end on the newer one, and the other one is a little more kind of mid-range sounding. So it might be sort of a preference thing, but.
Well, yeah, and some of that could be the improvements that I made in the system, because I completely revamped the system in 2011 or 12. I don't remember now.
Interesting.
Because, it's a very long story, which I'll try to make very short. But my former business partner, Doug Shepherd, and I built this system. And we had our own mastering facility called The Cutting System. And then a few years later, we wound up selling it to Future Disc in Hollywood. And they kept it until 2008. And so when I built the system that went in up at Acoustech, I had our cutting electronics, because we had built two sets of them. And so I bought one set from my partner, who he'd kept it. It was in his shop. So anyway, I had that. But the console and the tape machine were not the same. And I took a stock Studer tape machine and made a bunch of improvements to it. But it did not sound as good as the one that Doug and I custom built, because that had all custom built electronics in it.
Right.
And the same thing with the console, because I was using stock Sontek equalizers in the system that was at Acoustech, and it didn't have our Class A line amplifiers in it. And so anyway, in 2008, when I bought that system back from Future Disc, I kind of completely rebuilt my console and put those electronics that Doug and I had built into the new console. So actually, my new console sounds more like my original console.
So that was the leap, and we've talked about this before. That was, it's still many years ago at this point.
Yeah.
But
yeah, when I had bought that system back from Future Disc in 2008, and it literally sat out in the hallway at Acoustech, because there was no room for any of this stuff in the room. And so when I opened the new room, Doug had built all of the electronics in the console, so it all plugged together with this big snake umbilical, you know. And so I literally had it laid out on the floor with the equalizers and the line amps and, you know, all this stuff, and then the tape machine. And so I cut a side with what I'd been using at Acoustech, and then I cut it again with what had been the older system. And it was like, whoa, I mean, it sounded so much better. So that led to a year and a half that it took to rebuild that. And then I installed it between Christmas and New Year's in 2012 or 13. I don't remember now.
Well, and again, even in these years that we've been talking, I just think that there's a greater and greater recognition that the stuff that you're doing sounds so good and is kind of special. And it's like there's this upgrade that happens when we hear your version of it compared to what had been out previously. And so
thank you.
It's the accumulation of all that. Are you learning anything new from year to year, or is it pretty much like you just know what you're doing?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I've actually been asked that before, but in the first 5 years that I started cutting when I was working at Artisan Sound, I was learning so much. It was like exponential. And I remember after about 5 years, I said to myself, wow, I sure know a whole lot more about disc cutting than I did when I started actually doing it. You know, I mean, I think there are so many physics issues and things about cutting records that it takes a lot of doing to really understand what you're doing. Since that time, I would say it's probably been fairly minimal. But a lot of those things that I learned went into the decisions that Doug and I made in building our equipment to try to build a better sounding system.
Right. So there's not like one light bulb moment for 2024 or 2023 or something like that.
No, like, I wouldn't say that.
So Rhino, they also have their Rhino Reserves that are about to start coming out as well.
I'm not going to be involved in that.
And you're not involved in that. And I guess Chris Bellman's doing the first ones, and then Matthew Luthans is doing them. And yeah. he was working with you. Is he still working with you?
He is my protege. Yes. I'm very proud of what he's doing, and I'm happy for him.
So is he doing those at Coherent, or it says that at the Mastering Lab? Is that a different place then?
He's doing them, you know, at Chad's facility, which was the old Mastering Lab system that Chad bought, and it's in Kansas, you know, in the church there in Blue Heaven Studios.
He'll be going down to Kansas to do these.
He commutes back and forth all over. You know, he lives in Seattle. He works part-time in Salina, Kansas, and part-time in Los Angeles, California. And he's constantly going from one place to the other. You know, it's a round-robin kind of, you know, cross-country. I don't know how he does it, you know.
Did Patrick ask you first, like, hey, you want to take on another one? Or did they know? It was like, no.
No, he already knew I did not want to take on anymore. Because, you know, I've quietly complained a bit. You know, it's like Pat, you're kind of tying me down here, you know, and especially with the box sets on top of the every other month thing.
Right.
And in fact, you know, they never get the stuff as far ahead in advance as I would like, or even as far ahead as they say they're going to. So it's always, you know, it's always a kind of a crunch time to get those things done.
And you're still doing Blue Note, the Tone Poets with Joe Harley and the Classic
and the
Vinyl series as well.
Without Joe. And then the whole Concord thing, you know, I'm doing tons of stuff for them. You know, they call it in-house OJC2. I don't think they're officially calling it that, but it's the Prestige and Riverside titles
right.
that were part of the original OJC. We're redoing virtually all of those. They bought the Fania catalog, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago and did a whole bunch of that stuff. And
Joe Batan and all that.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I had never been a salsa fan, but I really began to appreciate particularly that record label and some of those titles. There's some great stuff in there.
Well, and that's another one where when those are mastered really well, just that kind of music, I don't know. I mean, it's like, I mean, I might just sort of be a sucker for this stuff, but when you have like salsa kind of percussion popping out of your speakers like that, you know, where, and you sort of feel surrounded by it, it's just really cool. And it just makes you, you know, it definitely raises my appreciation of the music because I'm like more immersed in it. I mean, I felt that way when with your version of Joe Jackson's Night and Day, because there's so much kind of percussive stuff going on in that I just hadn't, you know, heard when I'd heard the original, you know, CD or record of that. Mm-hmm. And the Blue Note is already, I mean, they just announced 2025's title. So have you done those already? Do they get you the stuff way more in advance?
I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, but we're doing 2027 titles right now.
Oh, wow.
We're that far out.
I saw that they announced for the Classic Vinyl, they're doing Donald Byrd Stepping Into Tomorrow. And I have this 45 RPM version that was cut for Vinyl Me Please, which sounds like amazing. It sounds really fantastic. Do you need to redo it when you do the Classic Vinyls, or are you kind of like, okay, I'm just going to take this, you know, whatever I've done for 45, obviously you got to make it 33, but is it basically the same thing?
Not quite. I usually completely EQ them. I mean, I start with a clean piece of paper, literally.
I wonder about the whole 45 thing. I feel like I see more complaints of people being like, I just don't want to get up and flip that record every 8 minutes or whatever.
That's exactly the way I feel. I've never been a big fan of 45s for that reason. It's a mood breaker, you know? I mean, records were sequenced and set up to be played, you know, continuously as a side. And each side is sort of programmed separately, you know? Unlike, you know, when they throw them on a CD, it's like, okay, well, you're hearing side one and side two in sequence, but each side was a separate thing. And, you know, and I've been involved in the sequencing of records and I know how that works. And, you know, you're kind of messing that up with a 45. I mean, I'm playing it in the same sequence, but with a huge gap in between, you know, the sides. It's just, it doesn't flow for me.
Is there a significant leap in the fidelity when you're going from 33 to 45?
I don't know how to quantify that. There's a particularly noticeable improvement on the very inside grooves of a 33 versus the 45, you know, where it's finishing farther out to begin with and going at a higher speed. Like, you know, I don't think I'm telling tales out of school here to say that, like, on say LA Woman, you know, Riders on the Storm on the inside is going to sound better on a 45 than a 33. And the same with, what was it? Was LA Woman the song on the other side? What
Yeah,
was the end
that
of it?
ends side one.
So it's gonna, you know, 45 is gonna have an advantage over 33. There's no doubt about it.
More of an advantage than like your half speed master, which you're not a fan of.
Oh, well, half speed doesn't do anything for that. You know, it doesn't matter how far. If it's cut on the inside of the disc at 33 and a third, it doesn't matter whether it's cut half speed or full speed. There's no advantage there at all.
Right. What do you think of the jump in all of the, like everyone's doing one steps now. Is that a good thing for music?
I've kept my mouth shut about that because I know too much. Let me just put it this way. One step is a scam. It's an absolute scam foisted on the buying public. And I'll just shut up right there.
No, but that's a good headline. But what's the next paragraph? What's a scam about it? That it's not really sounding any better, that it's sort of a marketing term
It's
and
a
not.
degradation. It's not an improvement.
What's the degradation about it?
Okay. You take a lacquer, you spray it with silver, and you plate it. Okay. When you pull the metal plate off, the silver stays with the metal plate, which is now your stamper, right? It doesn't stay with the lacquer. It goes, it's actually plated to the nickel, so it's now part of your stamper. If you go to press a record with the silver on there, it's going to peel off in little tiny confetti-like bits every pressing, right? And I remember Tim deParavicini wrote this thing and he says, oh, yeah, you just press four or five and it's gone after the 10th test pressing or whatever. Wrong. I talked to Rick Hashimoto at RTI about this years ago and he said, oh, man, we did one where we were getting bits of silver on the 100th pressing. So everybody figured out right away, you can't press it with the silver on there. So what do? You chemically etch it off. And then what do you wind up with? Something worse than what you started with.
So you're better off taking that extra step where you're not having all that.
Absolutely. Yes, the third step sounds better than the first if you press a record from each.
Huh.
Without a doubt. Joe Harley will back me up on this. When he was at AQ, they just decided, hey, you know, maybe doing these one step would be a cool thing. Nobody else was doing it at the time. He took one, listened to it, and he went, nope, the top end goes away and the air goes away and the echo tails go away. And it, you know, it's like,
Yeah,
you
Blue Note
know.
hasn't done the one steps, I don't think.
No, they don't.
Yeah.
It's because Joe's telling him, don't. Doesn't sound good.
Right.
Yeah, when I was at when I had my facility, which was called the Cutting System, I was working with Rick Goldman, who was a famous plating guy at KM. They were doing all the Sheffields, and Sheffield cut a lacquer, and they processed it one step, and they processed it three step, and they pressed from it, and the three step killed the one step. And there were six engineers in the room when we did the evaluation. And it was a total consensus. There was no, you know, there was no, oh, well, I don't know. This might sound better on that. Yeah. No.
Caro Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. So let's get to the other hat that you've enjoyed wearing lately, which is that you run a studio and a record company. So 2 years ago, we were talking about your new record that you were releasing and recorded in your home in Hackensack West by Kirsten Edkins, Shapes and Sound. Yes. Last year, you were about to release Hackensack West from Anthony Wilson. And then this year you've recorded a third record by another sax player, Corey Weeds.
That's correct. So yeah, Vancouver guy. The story about how that all came about was pretty funny too. Corey also has a label. It's not really a reissue label. It's more releasing unreleased stuff that he finds, all jazz. And his label's called Real, R-E-E-L, to Real, R-E-A-L. Are you familiar with that label?
No.
All right.
It's a good name.
I've been doing work for him for like, I think at least 8 years. I can't remember exactly when he started. And when Kirsten was kind of making a media push to get radio play on her album, I was looking at the jazz radio play charts every week. And here's this Corey Weeds record that's at number one and number two. You know, it was staying up there, for weeks. And so I just emailed him and I said, "Hey, Corey, are you the tenor sax player Corey Weeds that I see on the charts?" And he emailed back and he says, "Yeah, that's me." Okay. Well, I just sort of filed it away. I had it in the back of my mind. And then my granddaughter, Amber, had to pick me up somewhere. And in her car, she had something programmed in like Spotify or something. I don't know how that all works. And she says, "Hey, Grandpa, I got a jazz record here I think you're going to really like." And she hits play. And I went, "Yeah, this is great." I looked down at the screen, Corey Weeds.
Oh, that's great.
I called him immediately and I told him the story. And I said, "Can we do a record?" And he said, "Really? You want me to do an album for your label?" I said, "Yeah." He's like, "All right, let's do it."
Oh, I love that Amber discovered that.
Yeah, he put it in the liner notes. She doesn't know this yet, but he put it in the liner notes. So she's going to flip out when she sees it.
Did she come in for the recording session?
I have her credited as the A&R person for the
Nice. So was she there when you guys recorded it?
She was there for the rehearsal. She's going to college, and so she had to be back at school on Monday. But she came over Sunday night, which was really sweet. She met the band, and you know, Corey knew the story, and so you know they talked about it.
So is your plan to do like one record a year, or is that just kind of how it's been working out so far?
That's kind of how it's been working out so far. I would like to be doing at least two and maybe three or four, but we'll see how that goes.
Do you want to do follow-ups with Kirsten and Anthony Wilson as well?
I could. We've actually got probably 2/3 of an album of material that we didn't use on Anthony's record that's just dynamite. So we need to get him in and record a couple more tracks, and they wouldn't even necessarily have to be with the same other guys, because getting those guys together is like pulling teeth. But and Kirsten, I got to tell you, she is playing better than she ever has. It's just, I just did a new record for Bernie Dressel. It's called, he has a band called the BBB, the Bernie's Big Band. And he's her saxophone. She is his saxophone player, and she plays a solo and she plays the melody all the way through on one of the tracks on this big band record for Bernie. And she just shined. I mean, it was amazing. And I said, "Did she do overdubs?" And he goes, "No, nah, it was all done in one take." It's like, wow. Awesome. So yeah, it's possible down the road.
So what's the learning curve like as a label owner after all these years?
Oh my gosh, it's steep. I mean, I have produced records before in the past, but not post-COVID. It got a little crazy, with lead times on jackets and pressing and all of this kind of stuff. And my wife retired from teaching in May of this year, and so she's helping me with the stuff, which is really going to be great. I can use all the help I can get with the full-time mastering gig in addition. So,
So what have you learned as a label owner that surprised you, or that you sort of like filed away, like, okay, for the next one, I got to do it this way?
good question, and I've got an answer to that. The thing that really slowed us down on the first two records, on actually getting it out after it was recorded, was the time that it took with photographers, going through pictures, selecting the pictures, then going through the graphics with a graphics guy. And that, and in the case of Anthony, was totally nuts, because immediately after finishing the album, he's on the road with Diana Krall with the band. So, we're doing stuff via computer, and the photographer sending in pictures and all of this stuff, but it probably took 3 months to get the takes picked, a sequence, the pictures picked, and then to the graphics guy, and then graphics that's camera ready, to go to the printer. On this record, I knew all of this in advance, so I worked it out with Corey. I'm actually using his graphics guy, which is fine because I really like his work. If you go to Corey Weeds' website, CoreyWeeds.com, there's a bunch of his previous records, and they all look like Blue Notes and Prestiges. He's into the vintage vibe. So I had no qualms about that. But the beauty of the way this thing went down was just, the stars aligned, because they came in. The bulk of his band, the other three guys, are actually New York guys, playing. One guy's in Pennsylvania, but they all play together in New York. And Corey goes to New York, they go to Vancouver and play in the club that he plays at. So they came out, and we set the whole thing up so that they would arrive on Sunday. We would do a rehearsal Sunday night, and then record two sessions on Monday, two sessions on Tuesday. We did the rehearsal on Sunday night. They had everything but two songs out of seven rehearsed in 3 hours, and said, "Oh, the other ones are simple. We won't worry about those. We'll just do it tomorrow." They came in and they knocked out the album in 4 hours.
The whole
We
thing.
did a 3 hour we did a 3 hour session. They had like five of the seven tunes done. We took a long, kind of an extended lunch break, and then they came back and did like another hour, and finished the album. So, with Corey still in town, because he had, they were flying out on Tuesday night, and this is Monday night, he came in on Tuesday and listened to all the takes, picked the takes, and then the three of us started working on a sequence based on the takes that he had picked. Because I run simultaneous digital, and so it's easy to send files, to Joe and to Corey to listen to. So we had the thing sequenced and ready to cut like in a week, and I'm going to now cut it on the 26th of December and shipped to the plant for the first overnight to the 27th, and then we're rolling. And he's got a lot of the pictures picked out. We've got some kind of concepts for the graphics. He's written the liner notes, so we're really moving.
You got a
And
title?
I got to encourage people in the future to do this.
So you got a title for the album?
Yes, it's well, it's kind of tentative, but I think we're going with it. It's going to be Dig Weeds, exclamation mark.
When is it out? When can people order it?
Oh, again, we've got to do labels, jackets, and pressing. I mean, realistically, I would love to have it out by the 1st of March, and I think now I'm thinking it's doable. At first it was like a wishful thinking, but I'm hoping we can have it out by the 1st of March, just because of the lead time on the jackets and the pressing.
Do you have artists and bands now approaching you and saying either A, we want to record at Hackensack West, or B, we want you to put out our record on your label?
That's a great question, and that's a funny story too. I'll make it quick, but there's a guy who has a record out right now. You might have heard of it, Jacob Wendt. It's called Silver Street, and he approached me early last year, this year, early this year, maybe in February, March. He said, hey, I got a record that's kind of in the vein of what Coherent's doing, and I'd love to record it, you know, at your studio, which, by the way, officially is Coherent Recording. Hackensack West is the nickname.
But, yeah, I was using the nickname because we're being familiar.
Yeah, well, everybody is, of course.
Coherent Recording in the Valley.
Yeah, right. And of course, you know, I let Anthony run with it, you know, to use it as the title for his record. But so I basically said no to Jacob, and he said, okay. But he said, I'm going to have it recorded here locally. It's an engineer in Granada Hills who has a home studio also. And he said, would you be willing to master it? And I said, yeah, sure, I'll cut it for you. Even though I was turning a lot of business away, I figured it was the least I could do since he had asked me to record it, you know. Well, when I heard the record, it floored me, and I thought, oh, geez, this could have been a Coherent release, you know? And so he came in to listen to the test pressing because he hadn't bought a turntable yet. And we started talking, and it sounds like he's probably going to be our fourth album.
Oh, nice.
Maybe mid-year this year. We'll see. I mean, he's got to ride the tails of his record and kind of have it sort of reach some kind of a plateau before he wants to compete with himself. But it's selling really well. It's gotten great reviews. He's done the Jazz Bum show, and he's an old soul, you know.
I'll have to check that out. So you've been in the business for a long time, and slowing down would not be accurate to describe what you've been doing.
Only in terms of turning a lot of work away.
Yeah, but you're very, very busy, obviously. Is there any, you know, looking toward the next year, the next couple of years, are you looking to change the formula up at all, you know, in terms of how much you master versus how much you record, you produce, you know, put out albums on your own? Like, what's the future plan for you?
Well, can't really quite talk about it yet because I don't want to get anybody upset or create confusion. But yes, I'm going to try to focus more on the record label than day-to-day mastering. I love cutting records. I don't love the pressure that I'm under right now. It's stressful. And even turning away business, it's still been stressful this year. So.
And you haven't wanted to, like, expand your business and have this, you know, huge shop where you have like three mastering engineers reporting to you. And
well, Matt, I think is going to be doing quite a bit more work this year. You know, I've got him up to speed with Concord, with Blue Note, and with Warner, you know, because he's taking on that new Warner job project.
The Rhino Reserves.
So, I think that was probably my only concern. Are my clients going to be happy working with him? So I think it's going to kind of move toward him a bit, but I don't want to say too much.
Any other resolutions for 2025?
For the business, for the business,
for whatever.
Well, I want to do at least a couple of records in 2025. That's going to be the focus for Coherent.
Thanks so much again. It was wonderful talking with you. Talk to you soon. That's all for episode 163 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Kevin Gray for once again taking us deep inside his world of mastering and recording. If you go into a record store, look for Mastered by Kevin Gray on the sticker, and you'll know you're going to get a great sounding recording. You can listen to his work on all of the Rhino High Fidelity releases, Blue Note's Tone Poet and Classic Vinyl series, Kraft's Original Jazz Classics, and many more. You also can buy the two Coherent Records releases, Anthony Wilson's Hackensack West and Kirsten Edkin's Shapes and Sound, at the Acoustic Sounds and Elusive Disc websites. And look for saxophonist Corey Weed's upcoming album on the label over the next few months. To learn more about Gray and Coherent Audio, go to coherent.com. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, whose work sounds great at any speed. If you'd like to support Caropop, we'd be much appreciative. Please go to caropop.com and you can give $24 or whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carroll Pop on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter X at Carroll Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carroll Pop conversation. Thanks.